Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, President Trump is vacationing in Palm Beach, Florida, after refusing to sign or veto the $900 billion coronavirus relief package. Trump did veto an annual defense bill, in part because of a provision that would rename military bases named after Confederate leaders, and because it ignored his request to remove legal protections for social media companies. Congress is now preparing to return after Christmas for a possible override of Trump's veto, and that would be a first in his presidency.
The president also granted clemency to another 29 people yesterday, the latest in a flurry of pardons and commutations that this time included his 2016 campaign chair, Paul Manafort, and informal advisor Roger Stone, and Charles Kushner, father of Trump's son-in-law, Jared. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson is here. And Carrie, Manafort and Stone both refused to cooperate in Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Why did Trump pardon them?
Well, you know, in fact, actually, Robin, Manafort at one point promised to cooperate with the special counsel investigation, but the special counsel concluded he was lying to them, and it blew up his entire plea deal. So what President Trump has said about these pardons is that he called the Russia investigation a collusion, a hoax, and he said there was blatant prosecutorial overreach. He said Roger Stone was treated very unfairly and that he suffered under injustice. What the record would reflect, though, is that at one point, Paul Manafort, early on in his case, was advising his associate, Rick Gates, not to cooperate with investigators because somebody close to Trump had promised that Trump would, quote, take care of them if they didn't cooperate. And so that raises a lot of questions about the nature of their refusal to tell the full and entire truth, according to Robert Mueller, and what happened yesterday for sure.
Yeah. Well, Trump also pardoned real estate billionaire Charles Kushner, the father of Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner. Charles Kushner served 2 years in prison for fraud and witness retaliation. As Chris Christie, who prosecuted the case, said, Kushner seduced his brother-in-law with a prostitute, filmed it, and sent the film to his own sister to keep her from testifying. Christie, who of course became governor, explained the case to Margaret Hoover on PBS last year.
I mean, it's one of the most loathsome, disgusting crimes that I prosecuted when I was U.S. attorney. And I was U.S. attorney in New Jersey, Margaret, so we had some loathsome and disgusting crime going on there. But I just laid out the facts. And any objective person who looks at the facts knows, confronted with those facts, I had a moral and an ethical obligation to bring that prosecution.
So what did President Trump say about why he pardoned Kushner? And what's been the reaction?
Yeah, President Trump said that this pardon was supported by the former U.S. attorney in Utah and Matt Schlapp of the American Conservative Union, a close ally of President Trump. President Trump also talked about Charles Kushner's record of philanthropy after he finished serving his prison sentence. The president said that record of reform overshadows his record. But I got to tell you, the reaction has not been good. Congressman Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska, said that these pardons are, quote, rotten to the core. And other people are offended about the message it sends to other people who might consider breaking laws about public corruption or witness tampering, as Charles Kushner was accused of doing.
Yeah. Could these pardons have implications for Trump after he leaves office?
Well, a couple of things. One is, if the president does, in fact, want to run again in 2024, some of these pardons will carry a political taint that he could have to face again in the future in debates or in questions from voters. The second thing is that there are open questions about whether giving a pardon for reasons that would be corrupt could itself constitute a crime like obstruction of justice. Interestingly enough, Bill Barr, President Trump's former attorney general, said that might actually constitute a crime in his confirmation hearings. Unclear whether Joe Biden's Justice Department would want to do anything about that, but there have been investigations in the past of pardons and that presidents have granted on the way out the door.
Yeah, and we should say that those pardons last night, 29, came after more other controversial pardons earlier this week. Just briefly, got a few seconds. Should we expect more?
More are coming. Jack Goldsmith from Harvard Law School concluded that 86 of 94 pardons by President Trump had resulted from personal or political ties to Trump.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you.
Happy to do it.
With Trump's refusal to sign the pandemic relief bill, it's unclear what support Americans will get from Congress, if any. And that's not making life any easier for people like Jessica Parkinson. She's co-owner of Salt, a restaurant in Lakewood, Ohio. We've been checking in with her from time to time since March, when the pandemic forced her to temporarily shut down the restaurant. In April, she started curbside takeout. In July, she resumed table service, and when we spoke earlier this week, Jessica told me things are still really tough.
I would say, you know, it's been dismal and not great, and we are treading water at this moment. It's been kind of rough.
Yeah. When you close the books on 2020, what are you looking at?
As far as business goes, we're down about 80%.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So, for that reason, I assume that you were watching very closely what was happening in Washington, D.C. The relief package that Congress just passed includes a new paycheck protection loan program for small businesses. You got PPP money in the spring. Do you plan to apply again? Will that help you?
You know, for us right now, PPP money, when we applied for it and received it, we were literally one of the first businesses to receive it. And still, to this day, we don't know if our loan has been forgiven or not. So if we're going to have payments that we're going to have to make on it or how that's going to look, we still don't know. So for us to apply for another loan is, like, honestly, I really don't think we're going to do it.
Really? Wow. And that's saying something, considering your revenue's down 80%. I mean, that's a big decision to make.
It's huge because really, you know, my business partner, Jill, and myself, to be honest with you, we almost had all of our loans completely paid off by January, and we've only been open for 4 years. So for us to continue to take on more debt is not really something we're looking to do. So we just work harder and smarter and try to do the best we can so that we can go back to being Salt when this is all over with.
There's this statistic that says, as of this month, at least 110,000 restaurants have closed either long-term or permanently because of the pandemic. How much longer can you hang on at this rate?
You know, I told a customer the other day that came in, he asked how we were doing, and I said, well, we're white-knuckling it. And so for right now, we can continue to do that. Although our business is incredibly down, we are still, you know, making payroll and paying our bills and paying rent and all that. It's really forced our staff and Jill and myself to get really creative as far as the type of food product we put out, the wine program that we do, the cocktail menu that we put out. We were fortunate enough to receive money from the Bureau of Workman's Comp. And so we are taking that money and using it all for new inventory because, you know, bringing all new product in costs quite a bit of money. You need a lot of cash flow to do so.
And so you're white knuckling it like so many businesses right. around the country are. But it's also this time of year, the end of the year, when holidays are approaching. And that's when people traditionally go out and they spend a lot of money.
Right.
So this is a busy, important time of year for you. So, you know, you must be reflecting on that. It's not a very happy holiday either for you or for your business.
Right. No. And it's been incredibly stressful for those reasons alone, too. You know, December for us has never been a big business month, but it is busy for sure. And we start to rev up again in January. And January to June tend to be our busy six-month period. The way that the virus is looking and what the governor continues to do and not do for the state of Ohio is getting a little concerning for us, because we feel like we are going to be missing out on those busy months. You know, I have friends that are restaurateurs and own restaurants and bars, and they are struggling big time. They've lost their party rooms. They've lost large gatherings. And rightfully so. None of us disagree with what the governor's doing. It's just, you know, you've got to help us.
It's the start of a new year soon. And usually mm-hmm. that's a time when you can look ahead and be hopeful. But what you've just told me doesn't sound like you're looking ahead with hope. Do you have any optimism in the year ahead?
Yeah, you know, I was actually talking to my staff about it the other day. We are, we're a small staff to begin with, and now we're down to, there's nine of us here. I said, you know, guys, if we can just get to June, I think once June hits, we're going to be okay. And I truly believe that. I do. I think that once the vaccine hits and people are getting vaccinated around us, it'll give people a little bit more comfort in going out and dining. So I am optimistic about that. And I also keep saying, too, it's going to be okay. It's not okay today. It's probably not going to be okay in a month, but eventually it is going to be okay, whether that's us maintaining as SALT or if we do have to close our doors. Our biggest concern is keeping our staff safe and our customers safe and our doors open.
Well, you know, you're right. All of us, we just got to hang on. That right. should be our mantra, right? Let's hang on until June. Jessica Parkinson, co-owner of the restaurant SALT in Lakewood, Ohio. Why don't we keep checking in with you, if you don't mind, until we get to June and see how you're doing. Thank you so much.
I would love that. Thank you. Happy holidays.
Yeah, you too.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
What does this music conjure up for you? Okay, so for many, it's Disney's 1940 animated film Fantasia and the awkward and very funny ballet duet that a flirtatious hippo and a hungry alligator race through. But for others, well, get ready for an earworm you will not be able to shake. Hello, Mutta. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. It's the 1963 Alan Sherman song narrating a homesick boy's never-ending stay at summer camp. Well, both melodies are from The Dance of the Hours, which is a scene in a largely forgotten 19th century opera. But to hear now's music opinionator, Fran Hopfner, it is perfect pandemic music. So, Fran, yes, when I think Christmas Eve, I think Dance of the Hours. But, of course, you're thinking about the pandemic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It is kind of the perfect piece for just, you know, living one day after the other, watching the clock tick by.
Is that what got you thinking about it? I mean, had you listened to it recently?
I hadn't. You know, I listen to a lot of classical radio, so things will sometimes just play for me and then I'll think about them. But I was really just in my kitchen the other day and I started humming Dance of the Hours out of truly nowhere. And I thought, I don't know the last time I sat down and listened to this. And then I did. And I was like, I don't know why I'm not listening to this all the time. It's so delightful.
Oh, wonderful. We're going to hear more. But you can hear references to the passage of time throughout the piece. Let's just listen. It's like a clock. This was serious music, even though we had a hippo and an alligator and, you know, Alan Sherman. Tell us who wrote it, what it's from.
So this is by Ponchielli, who's a 19th century Italian composer. It's from his opera called La Gioconda, a very sort of classic romantic opera. It's actually based on a play by Victor Hugo, but this is like its big Act 3 set piece, which takes place during a party, actually. Something also from the past.
And the music from Dance of the Hours occurs in that Act 3. Dancers are portraying different hours of the day to entertain the guests at the party. And so it starts the beginning of the day very quietly. Let's listen. Fran, we're going to keep listening, but this is morning. But I'm getting it.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
If they're portraying a whole day, then we're just waiting.
Absolutely. And it's a little bit hesitant at first also. There's a little bit of reluctance to get into the swing of the day. This is very much a section for people who are maybe not morning people.
Then let's listen. The sun comes up. As if we doubted it ever would.
I know. It's so heartwarming. You can feel the warmth just radiating off that release.
And then we hear the Hello Mudda, Hello Fada theme repeated over and over. Look, you know, it has become sort of a punchline because of the song. But what was Ponchielli saying?
You know, La Gioconda is definitely a more serious opera than I think this piece extracted from it would let on. It's life and death. There's kidnapping. There's a dark plot that has to be foiled. But I think the Dance of the Hours is meant sort of at the midway point of the opera to break up the tension a little bit. And it is a party. It's not a comic party, but it's still a party nonetheless. And I think this is supposed to feel, you know, like a glimmer of joy in the midst of all the serious things happening within this opera.
Yeah. And there are kind of like jokes in it, but there's really beautiful music. Let's listen. Again, if you can take the Alan Sherman out of it, you know, what are you hearing here?
I just think this is so beautiful, and there's almost a yearning to it, a sort of grasping ahead for something that's maybe not quite there. And in the way that I think about this in the context of the opera, and it's not entirely a comedic piece, but I think those of us who grew up with Fantasia are inclined to think of it as strictly comedic. So I think it's important to point out maybe the less, you know, quote unquote, funny parts of the dance have a lot of, you know, nuance and, you know, texture.
Well, and Ponchielli isn't well-known today, but he was, in the mid-19th century in Italy, a composer of opera, big influence on his students, you tell us, like Puccini. And you can hear that. There are so many parts that sound very grand. You know, you've said to us, friend, that it's like sometimes you hear a piece, maybe it's the William Tell Overture, and all you can hear are, you know, cartoon characters. But we need to listen again.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and that's why, you know, when I was humming the more recognizable melody to myself in my kitchen, I thought, like, when was the last time I sat down and just listened to this piece? And I was just so surprised by how lush and romantic it is when so much of my brain is just filled with, you know, a hippo and an alligator dancing with each other.
Plus, there are other images. The dancer Marge Champion was part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Marge Champion, who's sort of, you know, a renowned 20th century dancer, like, lent all of her movements to Fantasia.
You know, Fantasia, just fantastic. I mean, you just, it's stunning to see what the creators did. But what was the response when it came out in the 1940s?
I think people were a little baffled by how experimental it felt. You know, so many of us grew up with this film, and so it feels very traditional and classical, but it's basically like a classical music review with really abstract animation. And I was reading the original review of the piece that was like, you know, it's disorienting and dreamlike, but I think this might be something really special. And I think Fantasia's absolutely, like, stood the test of time.
Yeah. All right, well, so we're listening to this day unfold. It's getting late. This grand waltz party is happening. And then all heck breaks loose. Let's listen.
And this too is so funny and fun. It reminds me of like the frenetic energy of Strauss. I just think it's so listenable.
And what were you doing as you were sitting and listening to this?
I mean, it makes me want to get up out of my chair and dance. It like genuinely excites me. It gets my heart rate going. And maybe that's sort of the magic of this piece, is that it can track the excitement and the boredom of a day just in like 12 minutes.
Yeah. And you've told us before that sometimes classical music for you is the thing that spurs you to housekeeping, to cleaning the house. and this would,
yeah, or cooking or sweeping. Yeah. Doing some decorating. This definitely has the, like, oh, I'm trying to clean up before. The end of the piece is actually sort of me before the party starts, trying to get everything arranged.
Well, would that we were having parties. They will come. They will come. Until then, it's Act 3 of Ponchielli's opera La Gioconda, and something that Fran Hoffner just, it popped into her head, and so she's now put it in ours. Fran, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And after months of tense negotiations, the United Kingdom and the European Union have reached a trade deal. The UK officially left the EU earlier this year, and the two parties have been haggling over their future. The deal comes just a week before the Brexit transition period was set to end, and more than 4 years after British voters narrowly passed a referendum to exit the EU. NPR's Frank Langford joins us from just outside London. And Frank, you've also been dealing with a strain of the coronavirus that shut borders. You told us there was fear that there'd be further border shutdowns with no deal. This must be welcome news. A trade deal the UK and the EU got to by resolving a difficult dispute over fishing?
That's true, Robin. Yeah, the issue is how much access the EU could continue to have to British fishing grounds. And Boris Johnson said this afternoon, the Prime Minister, that the UK would has about 50% of it now, and then the EU would continue to have the other 50%, but slowly over time, over the next 5.5 years, the UK would take more control. Now, this may seem odd to people because fishing is less than 1% of the British economy, but it was symbolic. If you go back to 2016, the Brexit campaign, the Brexit campaigners, such as Boris Johnson himself, said this was all about taking back control of from the EU, and that also includes fishing grounds and the fishing industry, which Johnson said he was trying to look out for in these negotiations.
Yeah, so does this deal remove all the uncertainty that British businesses were looking at?
No, it does remove some important ones. So, for instance, British businesses will be able to export into the EU, no tariffs, no quotas. That'll be very good for them. But customs will kick in on New Year's Eve, and so there still is uncertainty. And the other thing is that this deal itself is over 2,000 pages, I believe, Robin. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people may, businesses and also government officials, may be digging through it over the Christmas holiday to see what's really in there. And many businesses say that even with a deal, the government really hasn't prepared them for us. There will be changes at the border, and they don't really feel fully prepared or aware of what they're going to face.
Yeah. Well, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who really led the charge to leave the EU, spoke after this deal was announced. Let's listen to a little.
We will be your friend, your ally, your supporter, and indeed, never let it be forgotten, your number one market.
Well, Frank Langford, is that going to be enough to ease the hard feelings there might be on the other side of the English Channel?
No, I don't think so. At first, let's say I don't think what Mr. Johnson said is necessarily true. If you look at the EU, they say the largest partners are actually trading partners are the U.S. and China. There are a lot of reasons for these, for the U.K. and the EU to continue to cooperate. But the sense that you get here, Robin, is the UK is now off on its own. It's charting a very different path from the rest of Europe, and it's going to have to prove that this was the best new move for the nation and for its economy. And, you know, in Europe, people were saying today, well, our future is here in Europe, and Brexit is over, and we're moving on too.
Yeah. Well, so what is next, briefly?
I think we're going to see what happens at the border, certainly. The other thing is that Brexit really did divide this country. It's still divided. And one thing we've seen is since Scotland voted against Brexit, it's actually angered a lot of people in Scotland. And there's more and more talk of pushing for an independence referendum in the next 2 to 3 years in Scotland to leave the UK in hopes of one day rejoining the EU.
Well, and NPR's Frank Langford will cover it all for us. Frank, thank you so much.
Great to talk, Rob.
Audiences got a chance to see a very different Jim Parsons this fall. He's probably best known as Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory, the brainiac who can make a game of rock, paper, scissors complicated.
Anecdotal evidence suggests that in a game of rock, paper, scissors, players familiar with each other will tie 75 to 80% of the time due to the limited number of outcomes. I suggest rock, paper, scissors, lizard Spock.
But in the Netflix film of Mark Crowley's groundbreaking play, The Boys in the Band, Jim Parsons plays Michael, a gay man living in New York City in the late 1960s, who's throwing a birthday party for his friend Harold, if you could call him a friend. The party ends up being a disaster. Here's Michael speaking with his house guest, Donald, played by Matt Bomer.
Oh, you had to remind me. God, if there's one thing I'm not ready for, it is five screaming queens singing happy birthday.
Who's coming?
I think you know everybody anyway. And same old tired fairies you've seen around since day one.
Actually, you know what? There'll be seven, counting Harold and you and me.
Are you calling me a screaming queen or a tired fairy?
Oh, I beg your pardon. There'll be six tired screaming fairy queens and one anxious queer.
The Boys in the Band debuted off-Broadway in 1968. The 2018 revival won a Tony, and the entire cast returned for the Netflix version. I spoke with Jim Parsons about the film back in September.
And I know you weren't around in 1968. You didn't know much of the play until you had the chance to read the script. But now I'm sure you know that this was a huge deal when it first came out. This was a year before the Stonewall riots ignited the gay rights movement. The play was shocking to people. No one was ready to accept gay men at that time.
No, and one of the seminal things about this play in 1968 was that it was the first time that gay men had been given the central characters, or the only characters, in any piece that was presented. And it was really one of the first, if not the first, look inside gay culture, gay, what it was to be a gay person inside their own homes and in their when they collected together. People found that intriguing and wonderful even. But it soon after Stonewall did happen and gay liberation began, and this piece has really gone through a tumultuous history as far as it being rejected in many corners at different times by the very community it aimed to represent, who said, we don't want to be represented this way. These people seem to be self-hating. They have to hide. And time has, I don't want to say time has been kind to this piece, but this piece is, I believe, vital and was such an open vein for the author, Mark Crowley. What he wrote was so truthful and brutally honest from what he knew and saw and had been a part of that it has stuck around.
Well, some people in the community might agree that self-hate is off-putting in this, but, you know, frankly, it's one of the themes up front and center. Here's a clip from your character, Michael. He seems to hate himself at times, the fact that he's gay. He spends money as a form of therapy. His friends give him a hard time for being broke. And here he is with a house guest, Donald. And I do have to warn people that we're about to push up against the limits of what's safe for public radio here. So let's listen.
I went shopping today, and I bought all sorts of goodies. Look. Sandalwood soap.
I feel better already.
Oh, your very own toothbrush, because I am sick to death of you using mine.
How do you think I feel?
You've had worse things in your mouth.
Okay, so interesting thing about this production, as you well know, the cast is made up of nine gay men playing nine gay characters. Tell me about that. Did that change the dynamic at all among the actors or bring something different to the show?
It's hard for me to know what the ultimate effect of having nine out gay actors was on the show itself. For myself personally, it turned into a very powerful experience to be around all these gay men. I've never worked with a group that was all gay or even probably half gay in most of the things I've done. And I didn't realize what I'd been missing. There is a specific thing about being gay. There is a specific thing about being a gay person, in this case, gay man, growing up in this country. You know, there's all these unique features that I kind of take for granted or don't give that much credence to. And when we were all together, there was just a feeling I had that it couldn't be taken for granted anymore. There was something important going on here.
Let's go back to the plot here just a little bit. As the night goes on in this party, it gets tense. An old friend shows up unexpectedly. He's married to a woman, but his sexuality is unclear. Then your character, Michael, suggests a game where each guest has to call someone that they've truly loved from their past on the telephone. Let's listen to this.
Now, here's how it works. If you make the call, you get 1 point. If the person you are calling answers, you get 2 more points. If somebody else answers, you only get 1. And if there's no answer at all, you're screwed.
This turns out to be some sort of messed up party game.
Yes.
It's the point in the show. No, well, good. I'm glad to hear that because you seem like a nice guy. But and that's the point.
You.
I mean, at this point, you wonder if these guys really are friends at all. And Michael starts to show just a really cruel side, a dark side to his character. What's behind that tension? What's causing it?
One of the final lines in the play is the character of Harold that Zachary Quinto plays. He says to Michael, my character, you are a homosexual and you don't want to be, but there's nothing you can do about it. I do believe that's very much at the root cause of Michael's troubles. Michael and all these characters were living in a time where they were being told from all corners of what deviants they were. To me, one of the heartbreaking things, the premise of this game at its deepest point is to force, Michael wants to force each of them into going through this to realize how ridiculous the idea of true love is for a homosexual. That as a gay person, you will never know what it is to love, not in the way that everyone else gets to. And I just believe that they were living in a time that was teaching them that.
Is that something that resonates with you if you look back on your own life coming of age?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. And I'll tell you, one of the greatest blessings for me personally was that spending a couple of years essentially on and off with this cast, with this script, with this character, it really brought me to a place where, and it was a healthy thing. It wasn't overly painful. It was important, I think. But to realize that, you know, one of the blessings of the time that I live in as a gay man in America in 2020 is that there's not nearly the overt homophobic actions and statements and things to be exposed to every day. It's a completely different world than it was in 1968. The hiccup with that is that it makes it easier for someone like myself to ignore the more subtle ways in which I've been signaled in my youth, growing up, who knows, even now sometimes, little things that I'm like, oh, and you just kind of push it aside. But there is a part of me that does hurt. And to not acknowledge that nick, if you will, on your heart, on your soul, is to let it fester. I hope that makes sense. That's a little bit of a brain journey for you.
It certainly does. And you know what? You're Jim Parsons. People love you. People know you as Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory. It's hard for me to even think of you as someone who isn't just loved by everybody. And I wonder how your fans respond when you take on a role like this that is such a departure from this iconic character that you've become so well known for.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And it's one that, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but one that I kind of don't consider so much. I mean, the figuring out, as it were, remains the same now as it was for years now, which is, what's it going to be like to work with these people? What's it going to be like to work on this character? And in that process, what others will think of it is not, certainly not consciously, on my list of considerations.
Jim Parsons, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Before I let you go, I just want to bring it back one more time to the boys in the band. The playwright, Mark Crowley, as you know, died in March. There have been so many strides in the fight for equality. Is this play as powerful and relevant today as it was in 1968? And what do you think Mart would say about that?
I think Mart would be, frankly, a little bit surprised at the power and strength and longevity of his tale. I think that, like so many great works, they get realized their place in the canon, as it were, of great literature or moments in history much, much later. And partly that's because you can't know until it stood the test of time the way a piece like this has.
Jim, thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for your work. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Jim Parsons speaking with me last September. The Boys in the Band is available on Netflix.
Are you hearing Christmas music a little differently this year? Songs like I'll Be Home for Christmas or Christmas, Baby, Please Come Home taunt us when health officials beg us, don't go, not yet. But one Christmas song has maintained its hopeful melancholy for almost 80 years. Katie Sewell of the Bittersweet Life podcast has our story.
There is one song that stands apart from the others. It's wistful. And it's full of longing for bygone days.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
White Christmas was written by Irving Berlin, the same songwriter who composed Alexander's Ragtime Band and God Bless America. And people heard White Christmas for the first time ever on a radio show. It was Christmas Day, 1941.
Craft Music Hall with Bing Crosby, Mary Martin, John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, and the Music Maids and Hal. And here's Bing Crosby.
I like New York in June.
Bing Crosby and the Craft Music Hall was a show that mainly appealed to young people. So it's possible that the younger generation embraced White Christmas first. But the longing and coziness of the song had a deeper meaning that day. Families tuning into the Christmas broadcast were thinking about the tragic event that happened just 18 days before.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
The following year, in the winter of 1942, young American troops found themselves overseas during the holidays. An armed forces radio played White Christmas over and over to remind them of home. It's been a permanent part of the Christmas holiday ever since. Bing Crosby recorded the song for distribution in 1942. In an interview, he talked about traveling overseas to perform for the troops.
The song that was most asked for from me over there was White Christmas. Really got so that I hesitated about doing it because it caused such a nostalgic yearning among the men that it made them sad. And for this reason, several times I tried to cut it out of the show, but these guys just hollered for it.
By the end of the war, White Christmas was the best-selling song of all time. It held that distinction for 56 years. That is, until 1997, when Princess Diana died.
Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
Elton John's remake of Candle in the Wind was the first song to really challenge the popularity of White Christmas. But White Christmas is still a part of the holidays. And it may surprise you to know that unless you were alive in the 1940s, you've never heard the recording of White Christmas that made it famous. The radio premiere of the song on Kraft Music Hall was lost, and Bing Crosby's original 1942 master recording, the version heard by the troops overseas, wore out from overuse. The most familiar version is from 1947, when Bing re-recorded the song, hoping to recapture the original magic. For composer Irving Berlin, White Christmas was an unexpected hit. It was a simple song, just 54 words and 67 notes. It was written for a musical review about the holidays, a failed project that eventually became the movie Holiday Inn. Irving Berlin thought a different song from that film would become popular. Here he is.
I had a song in there called Be Careful, It's My Heart. That's the song I picked as the big hit, and it was a fair success. But I also had a song in there called White Christmas.
And that song won him an Academy Award and is still the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Which is interesting, given the fact that Irving Berlin didn't even celebrate Christmas. He was a Jewish man who immigrated from Russia as a child. And Christmas was a very sad and solemn day for him. While many American families opened gifts around the Christmas tree, Irving Berlin had his own tradition. Every year, he visited the grave of his son, Irving Berlin Jr., who died on Christmas Day, 1928, at only 3 weeks old. Perhaps it is this truly human melancholy that gives White Christmas staying power. 79 years after it first appeared on the radio, you're still likely to turn it up rather than off.
May your day be merry and bright, and may all your be white.
I'm Katie Sewell. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here Now.